Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, friends. I want to welcome you to tonight's Progressive News Network. When PNN salutes Florida's progressive women activists. This show is so important because it not only salutes the fine progressive women activists of Florida, but it speaks to these issues that are roiling in America's political system right now, when there are those forces among us who want to march us backwards a century or more to a different standard, to a different law. And they want to bring the law down heaviest of all on women. I call myself a fortunate son. I had a wonderful mother, two wonderful grandmothers. I have a wonderful wife and two wonderful daughters. And I'll tell you right now, these fine women are the equal of any male citizen around. And if you can't stand for the equality of women, then you're just not half a man. So tonight's show, we're going to be talking with some very fine women, some exceptional women activists, and I hope you enjoy the show tonight because you're going to hear some really good ideas. We've got Afifa Kasif of Floridians for a Fair Economy. Beverly Whipple of Military Families Against the War will be joining us. Chris Costello of Sierra Club. Meredith Ockman, president of NOW, Palm Beach. Anita Stewart, the Hillsborough County Soil and Water Conservation Board seat member. Susan Smith, president of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida. Jan Duma, deputy national director for PLAN, Progressive Leadership Action Network. And also a special guest, bringing a little comedy, a little levity at the right place, comedian Franny Sheridan at the end of the show. So I hope you stay with us for the whole show. As usual, I want to start off with a few news items that you may not have heard yet, because, of course, commercial news seems to mostly cover celebrity news. So let me start up right now and bring you some news on some fronts that you may not have heard too much about. The BP trial, which was scheduled to start tomorrow, has been postponed. The multi-billion dollar trial of BP over its part in the worst oil spill in the U.S. history was due to start Monday, has been postponed. BP is accused of ultimate responsibility for the 2010 Deepwater Horizon rig disaster, when an explosion in a well led to the deaths of 11 workers and hundreds of millions of gallons of oil leaking across the Gulf of Mexico. And I ask you to remember, friends, how much oil they said was leaking. And I think we know that we can take everything that they say with a very, very tiny dose of salt. BP faces fines and liabilities up to $52 billion. According to some analysts, the corporation has set aside $40 billion to deal with the fallout from the spill and has already paid out allegedly $7 billion in compensation to families of victims and others whose livelihood were affected. Transocean and Halliburton are also on trial. Bob Dudley, BP's chief executive, who replaced Tony Haywood after the disaster, told the Sunday Telegraph, "We have to remember we're a business that invests in decade-long cycles. If the trial goes to 2013 or 2014, the history of BP and the way the energy industry works, we have to think in terms of much longer. Hopefully we will reach some agreement. We'll be able to reduce the uncertainty and move forward. But the appeals process of various branches, so it could go down in terms of time, could be a lot longer than 2014. So this will be some more entertainment for us. The search for justice and BP. And I need you to keep an eye on that, not just for you, but for tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Also, from the Florida Follies in Tallahassee, the government noticed there's been this problem with foreclosures. So Dave Simmons of Maitland, a Republican, imagine that, says that roughly 371,000 foreclosure cases still clog Florida courts. Some lawmakers believe the only way to get the housing market back online in solid footing is to speed up the process. So guess what? They want to take the courts out of the program. That's right. Now, he's got a bill that will force homeowners to show cause why they should keep their property. Now, imagine that. You've got to prove why you should stay in your home. Representative Kathy Pasadomo of Naples has a bill that would follow 30 other states by establishing an alternative system for processing foreclosures outside the legal system. And I'm sure you know that they only want to do that to make sure it's fair to you, the consumer. on the Fukushima front, because you know what, friends? There is and continues to be a Fukushima front. Right now, they're trying to get a waste processing plant online. Of course, it's a day late and a dollar short. This is from the Reuters. Critics say the nuclear waste plant is too little too late. The plant will be big enough to handle the long-term problem. Other solutions are needed, such as underground storage. And, of course, in Japan, underground storage has its own special features. On a hillside in northern Japan, wind turbines slice through the cold air, mocking efforts at nearby industrial complex to shore up the future of the demoralized nuclear plant industry. The wind power plant at Rokkosho has sprung up close to Japan's first nuclear reprocessing plant, a Lego-like complex of windowless buildings and steel towers, which was supposed to have started up 15 years ago. But it's only now starting completion. Dogged by persistent technical problems, it's designed to recycle spent nuclear fuel and partly address a glaring weakness in Japan's bid to restore confidence in the industry, shredded just last year when people noticed, when a quake and tsunami wrecked the Fukushima Daiichi plant to the south, triggering radioactive leaks and mass evacuations. But the Rokkosho project is a little too late, according to critics, who say Japan is running so short of nuclear waste facilities that the entire industry risks a shutdown within the next two decades unless a solution is found. You don't build a house without a toilet, said Jitsuru Terashima, president of the Japan Research Institute think tank and a member of the expert panel advising the government on national energy policy after the Fukushima disaster. Wait, let me read you that quote again. It's a really pungent quote. You don't build a house without a toilet. In other words, you can't have a nuclear plant and a nuclear industry if you don't have some way of, you know, dealing with the waste. If Japan seriously wants to stick to nuclear power, a second Rokkosho said, a second one would be needed. Long-term storage of highly radioactive waste is a problem common to all nuclear-powered nations, including the U.S., but experts say that Japan's unstable geology and densely populated terrain means that its challenges are far bigger. The Rokkosho plant is finally due to start up in October, barely 19 months after the radioactive clouds at Fukushima sparked the world's worst nuclear crisis in 25 years, a crisis exacerbated by the, check this out, 1,800 tons of spent fuel. That's almost 2,000 tons of spent nuclear fuel rods being stored at the power station when the disaster struck. As Japan approaches the anniversary of the March 11 quake, there's an anniversary you want to remember, the nuclear power industry, which just over a year ago supplied a third of its power, is virtually paralyzed. All but two of Japan's 54 reactors are offline. Looks like it's not going to be the solution. The reactors have steadily been shut down for maintenance, unable to restart until they meet the new stress tests aimed to determine if power stations in the future can withstand the kind of terrifying natural force unleashed on Fukushima, a magnitude 9 quake in a wall of water more than 30 feet high. Effectively, though, utilities have to do more than pass the stress test. They have to finally convince the local governments that the waste problem will be resolved, something that they haven't really figured out yet. At Fukushima, where the highly radioactive spent fuel rods were crammed mostly into pools of water inside the complex, when disaster knocked out the cooling system, it led to a fire in one of the pools. A fire in the cooling pool. At that time, it was a bigger concern than even the risk of a reactor meltdown. Check that out. At the time, the fire in the cooling pool, with its 2,000 spent fuel rods, was a bigger concern even than the reactor meltdown. Interesting. Puts it in perspective. The governor of Ehime Prefecture, Tokohiro Nakamura, who supports nuclear power, provided that the safety is ensured, says it's time to finally tackle the waste issue, including the option of not only reprocessing but storing it deep underground. He blames successive national governments for failing to take the hard decision. It's a traditional theme, he said, the history of their fleeing from the risk of losing an election. The clock is ticking, they say. Oh, and by the way, they say the new plant, this new waste processing plant, the record's not encouraging. Some experts expect further delays, pointing to a long-standing problem at its kiln. That's how they deal with the waste. An essential part of the plant that deals with the high-level radioactive waste that cannot be recycled into fuel. The kiln turns the waste into glass, a more stable substance than is intended to be stored in the ground. Now, the plant operator, Japan Nuclear Fuel Limited, has had to make some minor design changes to the kiln. Interesting, listen to that. Which is larger than the industrial standard kilns developed and used in France. So this is the largest one they've ever been built. And, well, they've had to make some modifications. JNFL had opted for a larger kiln to cut costs. Okay, cutting costs, they're going out on a limb. Ultimately, though, even if Rokkasho gets up and running, two problems remain. It alone cannot recycle enough fuel to stop the waste mounting up, and there's still the issue of burying the vitrified waste permanently in a crowded, quake-prone country. When the safety and political conditions are met and some reactors are restarted, we still have another high hurdle to clear. That's storage of the spent fuel, and that space is running out. The aim of recycling more spent fuel, Japan had planned to separate the plutonium at the Rokkashima processing plant and combine it with uranium to produce a mixed oxide MOX fuel. JNFL plans to build a MOX fuel facility close to the plant with a scheduled launch date of 2016, way out there. But this idea, along with Japan's entire energy policy, is under review after the disaster of Fukushima. The ruined station had used MOX fuel, which raised grave concerns for the human health because of the presence of dangerous plutonium isotopes, a decent burial. With Japan's recycling efforts running so far behind the required pace to deal with the waste problem, Japan needs to find another resting place for its waste away from the coastal nuclear plants. And unlike France and the U.S., the world's largest atomic power generators, Japan does not have much in the way of geological stable or empty landscapes in which to bury nuclear waste. Given its population density is 10 times higher than the U.S. and almost 3 times higher than France, Japan faces a not-in-my-backyard problem like no other big nuclear power. Amazing. It certainly has nothing to do like the deserts, nothing like the deserts of Nevada, where Washington has been developing a burial chamber deep inside the mountain before shelving the project. The U.S. also stores its waste at power stations nationwide, and it, too, is being urged to quickly find a burial site in light of the Fukushima plant. Okay, enough of that. I'd like to bring on my first guest, Afifa. Afifa, are you there?
I am here.
That's fantastic. Afifa, why don't you introduce yourself? You're with Floridians for a Fair Economy. Tell us a little bit about yourself and about the work of Floridians for a Fair Economy.
Okay, perfect. So my name is Afifa Khadiq, and some people call me Afifa Kashif, but what I have been doing all my life is fighting for the rights of marginalized and poor communities all around the globe. I have been working internationally for minority rights, women political rights, rights of bonded laborers, all sort of stuff. I've been working on political and legislative strengthening in marginalized countries. So, you know, all this kind of stuff. So now I'm working on a very good and great cause. It's called Floridian for Fair Economy. Our concept is pretty simple. Is there are 99% of Floridians who are paying taxes, and we just want to know that why the richer 1% are not paying their fair share. We are not asking them that, you know, it's not right to make any profit or make money or it's bad to be rich. We're just asking them to pay their fair share. So in very simple terms, this is what Floridian for Fair Economy is doing.
Excellent. Excellent. Tell me, what started you on the path from being just another consumer out there in the world to being a person who's trying to work to make this a better place?
For once that, you know, I am a concerned Floridian. I am one of the 99% who is paying my fair share of taxes, and I personally believe that, you know, each and every citizen who is using the resources of, provided by this great Florida region should pay their fair share towards development of Florida. So this is pretty simple concept, right? Mm-hmm. So what we have seen is that, you know, public services are being cut, services for our senior citizens, services for disabled, services for our teachers and students and health sector, you know, wherever you see the services are being cut. So that kind of, you know, raises this question that, you know, if we are looking at the cost-saving solution, and I don't know how much of cost-saving solutions they are, but, you know, supposedly if this is what we are calling them, then why we are not looking at the revenue generation solution? And it makes pretty common sense to me.
You mean that all problems may not be solved by cutting taxes on corporations?
Well, you know, I know that there are some cost-saving solutions that we need to look into. For instance, the management-to-staff ratio in the government sector. We are open to all, but, you know, if there is a segment of the society that just want to put this on table, like cost-saving means cutting down public services and not putting everything on table, which also include revenue generation, then that raises question as to intent of the fair intent of the group that is raising this solution.
Well, I remember during the last election cycle, a local Florida legislator in the area that I live, Gail Harrell, assured the members of the Chamber of Commerce that we could just cut these taxes, cut them across the board, and there'd be no impact whatsoever on housing, on benefits for the community, on families and children, on schools, on hospitals, on police stations, on fire stations. No level of service, because this would free up corporate money, and the famous, it would give them certainty. I don't know about you, but every time I pull up to the pump, that's pretty uncertain to me as to what price I'm going to have to pay. Have you seen a complete, you know, how would you see, what effectiveness have these legislative changes in taxation? Have you seen an increase in jobs from corporations? Have you seen, on the other hand, have you seen cuts in benefits and services?
Well, I have certainly seen the cuts and cuts in the benefits and services, but I haven't seen really a job creation. And I am totally, you know, if this is the argument that cutting down taxes can increase the jobs, I'm all for it. Or if cutting down taxes means the development of Florida, I'm all for it. So one of the bills that we have proposed in the legislative assemblies of Florida in Senate and House was pretty simple. Like, okay, so if you say that, you know, over tax cut has created the jobs and, you know, have impacted the economic development of Florida, then just show it. Like, you know, it has to be accountable. People of Florida has every right to know if they are paying their taxes and some particular group are not paying their taxes, particularly the rich corporations, then we want to see that it has actually happened in Florida. So one of the bills that Senator Evan Jenny in House Representative Evan Jenny in House has presented, and Nan Rich and Oscar Brennan has presented in Senate, is pretty simple. It's like, you know, if you are saying that you have created jobs, then show us.
That sounds like a good idea to me. All that talk of generating jobs by the trickle-down theory, I'd sure like to see some evidence of that, and certainly if they had evidence, they would be talking about it.
Yeah, perfectly. You know, because if you are saying that we have cut down taxes and it has not impacted Florida at all, then, you know, just imagine if there is no police officer doing, you know, around in your locality. Just imagine the crime rate and stuff that can go high. Or if, for instance, there is this great campaign going on in Miami. It's called Every Minute Count, because they have basically cut down 18 minutes from the services of the senior citizen. And what it has actually done to senior citizen, it has increased the falls, it has increased the infections leading to premature death, it has increased the risk of bed sores, malnutrition, dehydration, reduced personal interaction. Like, you know, how can you justify that? Like, I don't want to pay my fair share in the development of Florida, and it will not impact Floridians. It doesn't seem to be a very logical argument.
Could you talk a little bit about this Rick Scott funding tug of war? I see there's a campaign on your website about that. Is that something you could talk about?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the thing is that what this government is right now trying to do is, and I mean government of Florida, is basically there's a tug of war between all different services. Please don't cut services for homeless, or don't cut services for education, or don't cut services for health. But, you know, our point is that we should not be cutting services for any public service. The Floridian, the 99% of Floridians that are receiving these services are already marginalized. They depend on these services for their everyday a matter. For instance, you know, if you are cutting down on education services, and then at our school level we have to choose between a playground or a science lab, it's both of these things for me is very necessary. Like, you know, I can't afford to send my child to a private school that is getting all this money, and all the rich corporations, their children are going there. I can't afford to do it. So why should I be suffering when I am paying my fair share also? So what we have introduced in our legislative assemblies is a bill. It's actually a series of bills. These are three bills, one in House and two in Senate, and it's called Fair Economy Act. And the bills in Senate are presented by Nan Rich and Oscar Brennan, and these bills are simple. Even if you don't want to impose any new tax on any rich corporation, just eliminating a few tax loopholes will bring an additional $500 million of revenue for Florida. And how good that sounds. What we are asking the rich corporations to do is to do a combined reporting for all their subsidiaries. Just make one report, and we anticipate it will bring almost $440 million in additional revenue. Then we are also talking about the throwback rule. Like, you know, there are so many different states that are not charging any tax on the sales made over there. So what we are asking them to do is to throw back to the money in Florida if these companies are originating from Florida, and pay the taxes in Florida, and it will bring an additional $46 million in revenue. So when we are seeing all of it, that, you know, cutting down the education or cutting down the health, and then we see the next era energy is paying minus 3.8% of the taxes, that's kind of ridiculous.
I noticed that in your concern for the Florida legislators, you gave them a big Valentine's Day present. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah, sure. So we want them to be Floridians' Valentine. They have, you know, they are in there because they have got support from 99% of Florida. They are not there because they got, you know, 1% of Florida's vote. So we want them to be over Valentine instead of the Valentine of the rich corporations. And we are targeting some of the rich corporations like Carnival Cruise Line, who is not paying any tax on their on the sales of their tickets. We are targeting Darden, that is asking to, you know, Florida's government, they are pushing for a bill that says that, you know, if we haven't used our federal tax credits, then we can use it in our state tax. Already they are not paying any tax, so maybe they want more money from Florida. Then we have Verizon Wireless that, you know, have in 1 year alone, they have devalued their property in Palm Beach by $17 million. That has costed our school board $4 million of revenue that they were collecting in past years. Then there is Citigroup, who is in a swap scheme with Palm Beach School Board, and Palm Beach School Board have to pay them like $9 million a year. So all these companies that are basically benefiting from the resources of Florida and then just looting Florida's public services also. So in a kind of a protest, we want our legislators to be over Valentine instead of, the Valentine for rich corporations. And, you know, they are showing that they have more love for rich corporations than for people of Florida.
Well, I think it's always wonderful when you can use a little humor to nudge people in the right direction.
Yeah, I hope it works also.
Well, there's always a chance.
Yeah. You know, there is kind of, you know, lack of sense of humor up there. So I don't know if it's working.
Now, I see another story on your website about the work that you're doing. Florida Senate leadership snubs $500 million in revenue. Is that essentially addressing some of the taxes that could be levied?
Well, yeah, we have been basically saying that, you know, we can generate $500 million of additional revenue, but, you know, you just don't have to impose any new tax if you have that much love for rich corporations. Just eliminate some of the tax loopholes, and we are not even proposing where this money should be going. It can go to any public services. $500 million is a big sum of money when you look at Florida's revenue. We had $2 billion of budget deficit this year, and basically this House and Senate, they have to, you know, cover this budget deficit. And there are so many different tax loopholes also. For instance, if you are in Florida, you better be an ostrich because, you know, then you don't have to pay any tax on your feed. But if you are a disabled child or if you are a senior citizen, then you are paying taxes on your food. So better be an ostrich. So so there are so many different tax loopholes that we have seen. And if we, you know, if there is basically a political will up there in Tallahassee and they eliminate all these tax loopholes, they can easily generate more than $2 billion in taxes.
You know, I heard during the last legislature that they reduced the taxes on private airplane sales and on private yacht sales. And I just thought, my goodness, you know, the children that could have been fed if they just hadn't reduced those taxes. I'm not saying crank them up. God knows they don't do that. But just, you know, seeing that these corporations pay their fair share. And when you hear about, you know, school boards having to pay out, it's really so unconscionable. I notice here, I'm going to read off some of the list of some of the things that could have accomplished. Eliminate 27,000 people waiting list for seniors and persons with disability who are eligible for nursing homes but haven't had a chance to take advantage of it. Hire 8,600 more teachers and lower the average classroom size. Ensure that more than 600,000 uninsured children in Florida would be eligible to be covered under kid care. Eliminate the waiting list for families who have children with disabilities. Ensure a 5-year freeze on tuition and fee increases for colleges and universities. Restore cuts to student financial aid, including the Bright Future scholarships. Provide more than 66,000 Floridians with the opportunity to advance to home ownership through the first-time home buyer program. And fund Everglades Restoration and Restore Florida Forever program, providing funding for the alternative water supplies. You know, too many people, it seems to me, have discarded the idea of the stewardship of the land. It surprises me because I always thought that conservative meant to conserve and preserve the water, the habitat, not exploit it to the max. And it's such a shame. What kind of effort do you see for the next, you know, with this legislative wrap-up? Do you have any plans for the end of this legislative session?
Oh, yeah, sure. We really want Florida legislators to look into these acts. They still have time. The Senate is passing their budget. They can still pass these legislations and just, you know, prove that they are there to work for Florida. Well, if they don't do it, then we are definitely going to go to their district and let them know that we are not happy about it. Floridians will react to it. We will be holding on accountability sessions. We will be doing candidate screening. We will be asking questions about the fair economy stuff. We you know, just in like, you know, a day or two before, there was this meeting that Alan West has organized, and Floridians, they have asked him this question about taxing the rich, and obviously he said no, it doesn't make sense because that's the one who are funding their campaigns. But, you know, ultimately they are responsible and answerable to 99%, not just the 1%. So we will be holding on accountability sessions. So I'll ask everyone to log on to our website, www.floridafaireconomy.org, and just, you know, sign up for email update and information. And we will be letting them know what they can do to support this campaign.
Well, thank you so much, Afifa. You've been very informative. Why don't you go ahead and read your website address one more time so people can make sure they get it, and just a little slower.
Okay. So it's www.floridafaireconomy, and it's all one word, .org.
Well, thanks again. And I wish you every success, and please come back again soon, okay?
Sure. Thank you, Rick.
Okay. You take care then.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. Well, that was a wonderful report, and I've got some more guests to bring on. Let's see here. Good evening. Who do I have now?
Hi, Rick. This is Meredith Hoffman.
Ah, Meredith. Welcome, Madam President. How are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
Real good. I've got one other guest on hold here, and let me bring her on also, and then I'll let you both introduce yourselves and talk a little about what's on your front burner, okay? Hold on one sec. Hello, who do I have? Is this Susan?
No, this is Anita Stewart.
Oh, hi, Anita. Welcome. So I just got Meredith and Anita on. Let me ask Meredith first, would you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're working on right now?
Okay, well, I'll give you the basic rundown. My name is Meredith Hoffman. I'm the president of Palm Beach County National Organization for Women and vice president of Florida National Organization for Women. We have a couple of huge events that are going on. One is the our 39th annual Susan B. Anthony Feminist of the Year Award Luncheon. That's a Palm Beach County event that's been happening. We're now on, like I said, the 39th year.
Fantastic.
So our cast of characters is going to be incredible for this event, and it's going to be on March 18th at the Boca Country Club from noon to 3.
Okay, great. Thanks, Meredith. And let me go ahead and let Anita introduce herself.
Hi, my name is Anita Stewart. I'm with the Hillsborough County Soil and Water Conservation Board. I'm also an activist in regards to the Gulf Coast. So that news that you announced at the very beginning of the show was a little upsetting and unnerving, to say the least. I do a lot of other activism. I try to stay active with Occupy and with the Occupy Tampa specifically, and Occupy Hernando, which has changed its name to Occupy Nature Coast.
And you're also doing some webcasting, right?
Yes, I'm doing the Wise Women Media Show, which showcases women over 40 that are changing the world. So we broadcast every Monday night from 8 to 10 on Blog Talk Radio through Here Be Monsters channel. So.
The lovely and talented Gwendolyn. I'll tell you, it's so great. You know, the work that you two collectively are doing is just marvelous. Meredith, let me ask you a question first. You know, we're seeing this parade of 19th century social plans in front of us. What kind of what tactics is now planning to use in this next election to make sure that the vote of sensible, intelligent people comes out, some kind of sensible response to this, incredible. I know that words fail me at what these people are up to. What can you tell us about either now locally or now nationally in terms of how they're responding to this back to the past stuff?
Well, I mean, between the local, between my local office and doing as much contact with the community and letting people know what the truth is around these the issues that have been brought to our attention, and Terry O'Neill, the national now president, going on national television and doing a lot of national work. We've both been taking on the issues a huge amount. Let me just say, I don't believe it's the case that the United States are nearly as conservative as some of these conservatives, particularly those who are running for president, would like to make it seem as though that's the case. I think right now we've seen a huge shift to the right in the political platforms, specifically because they are running for office and they're trying to get the most conservative of votes. What I think is going to happen is naturally the electorate is going to require that these people running for president move more to the center, regardless of how they're touting now. With that having been said, I can tell you that there's a lot of work being done on the ground, particularly, you know, making sure that people understand this contraception issue and the fact that it didn't have anything to do with churches, that sort of thing. And, you know, the churches tried to exploit the issue, but I don't think that the issue was about the churches or religion. And I think that it's absolutely the case that we need equal health care coverage for anyone who works in this country or for anyone who does not work in this country, period.
Well, I agree with you also about where the electorate is. But, you know, one of the questions that kind of rises in my mind, there was a pretty solid critique of this across the board, legislators across the United States, with all this incredible abortion limitations, sex limitations, sex education limitations, with the critique being that they never talked about it during the election. And so this is kind of out of left field that they're doing this. But this time around, even though I agree with you that the broad American electorate isn't in that place, this time they are talking about it. And if this time they are talking about it, I kind of a shudder to imagine what the heck they've got in mind for a legislative agenda in the future. But before I get you to react to that, I want to ask that same question of Anita. Anita, you know, what do you think is the sensible local or regional reaction to this kind of stuff? Clearly, the Florida legislature is reading from the same ALEC playbook. What do you tell people about when these issues come up?
That's a hard question. Because I just say, you know, if these issues come up, I just say, what are these issues? And the way they're presented, who does it benefit? And follow the money, too. That's the other thing. So,
well, who does it benefit is always a good question. And, you know, you have to wonder. I was at a family gathering over the past weekend. And, you know, essentially this seemed to be ringing a bell with certain people, kind of the morality police bell. You know, this is kind of a delayed reaction to the free love 60s sort of thing. You know, they're taking their turf back. They're proclaiming their morality. They're saying that even the battle of contraception, which most of us thought we won about a century ago, you know, they're saying, well, you know, this is all about casual sex, and they're trying to, you know, bring back family values. I think we have to articulate the fact that, you know, sexual freedom, sexual license are not the same thing. The right to control one's life destiny is what this is about. You know, again, many of us thought this battle was won a century ago.
It relegates women back to a second-class citizen-type status to have these laws pushed and forced through. And I'm amazed that they can have these panel discussions without any women on the panel. That is just amazing to me that we allow that. We have to be very vocal, and we have to also keep informed on when these panel discussions are taking place, and we have to be present there in full force.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you, and I want to ask the panel tonight, is, you know, there's 17 women senators, 5 of them are Republicans. Where the hell are the 5 Republican women on these issues? Are they going to sit silently by while these Neanderthals, you know, pitch this nonsense to the American people, scare them into it in a fever pitch of war hysteria? I mean, they must have better sense in this. They must demand more responsibility in their own hands. I find it appalling.
Well, and number one, I think that they... they're voting down party lines in a lot of cases, and then but secondly and more importantly, if you look at the situation with the Komen Foundation and how they had to reverse their decision to remove health care coverage for cancers from Planned Parenthood, it's a blatant, obvious description of how description of how the electorate and the people that are being governed by this extreme radical right is not on that side. It's clear. National Now has over 550,000 members across the country. It says something when we have that kind of a movement, when we have that many people calling our legislators, telling them we're not happy with the situation, and the legislators are trying to take us to a place where we don't belong, where we don't want to be. It's back to a place where we don't have equal rights, and that's where the big issue is. We need mm-hmm. equal rights. Better than that, we need equal health care coverage. We need to be heard, and they're not hearing us.
And let me put in a shameless plug. I will be having Sandy Oestreich on my show tomorrow night.
Oh,
and
great.
She will be talking about the ERA amendment and the fact that it was never made into law in certain states, and Florida is one of those states. And people need to know this. In fact, a lot of the younger people, especially some of the younger women at Occupy, have no idea about the history of the ERA amendment and the Equal Rights Amendment, and they need to hear this show.
You know, with all due respect to Occupy, I also saw a list of several things that they're going to be talking about in a forum that they're doing, and none of those things included women's rights. And as a matter of fact, there were two women who were on the panel that didn't talk about women's rights in particular, that didn't talk about those particular issues. So, you know, I don't know that Occupy is necessarily going to be the savior, although I support Occupy and I understand what they're, you know, I understand most of the points that they're making. I don't know that it's necessarily the place that women's rights are being represented. National Organization for Women is where women's rights are being represented. We've also been working with Sandy Oestreich over the years to try and get the ERA passed, and we've also been doing that side of the work where we've been represented in the legislative delegations and have done what we can to make sure that if nothing else, that people know that it's there. That's why Lori Berman went forward and brought the ERA in as, you know, the ERA to the Florida legislature again.
You know, thank you. That's good information. And, you know, there are so many battles we're all working on right now, so many challenges that everybody can't cover everything. One of the other just inflammatory, incendiary charges that I heard in the last week or so was Newt's infanticide charge. That President Obama is the president of infanticide. There's been more abortions and all. And I want to juxtapose.
Oh, yeah.
I want to juxtapose that with something else I heard this morning on the Sunday chat shows, which I found kind of amusing. Zbigniew Brzezinski basically reacted when asked on just a couple different Republican quotes from the last week's madness, said, you know, I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed as an American that this is the kind of talk that we hear out of a major party. I mean, in this country, for good and ill, and mostly ill, we have two parties. There are two parties articulating for better and worse, what at least the positions that they try to strike out for the American people. And this charges of infanticide, when we should be, when this is such incredible framing, it's hard to imagine how you build a bridge of intelligent conversation to someone who's making charges like that.
Well, I don't believe that Newt Gingrich is going to be the nominee because of that, because he's not logical, because he doesn't follow suit with a logical thought process that people can follow. He's not personable, and he's not somebody that I think anyone's really going to pay attention to after this, you know, stint for president. He may have another book or two, and you know, but I don't see him necessarily going the. That's why he hasn't won any states. That's why he's Ron Paul has done better than Newt Gingrich in this race. I mean, that says a lot.
And Richard, you mentioned also, where are these Republican women and where do they stand? I think a perfect example of where Republican women stand on women's rights is, I can't recall her name, but she was the woman on Fox that was talking about women in the military and the issue of rape, and then she made a comment that, you know, now the feminists are rising up because they're being raped too much. And I remember that was like the big thing on, you know, the nightly talk shows. I can't recall her name, but that, I believe, is the way most Republican women think about women's rights. She was a perfect example of that.
Well, that's a good food for thought. Let me bring on somebody. I think we've got one more guest with us. Hold on one second. Good evening. Welcome. Who's this?
Oh, are you talking to me?
It sounds like Jan. Hi, Jan.
Yes, it's Jan. You know, it just sounds the same if I'm listening to the show or if I'm on the show. I can't tell you're talking to me. Hello?
Hi. Welcome, Jan. I was just talking to Meredith and Anita. Why don't you go take a moment and introduce yourself? We were talking about Republican women and where they stand on all these incredible inflammatory statements. Jen is go ahead. Give me your title. You're with Plan.
Okay, I'm the Deputy National Coordinator of the Progressive Leadership Action Network, and also a writer, author, and financial advisor.
Okay, hold on a second. Okay, that's good. Jen, you are have been very involved in the grassroots development of Progressive Leadership Action Network, and you know, you talk to an awful lot of people, and as I recall, the economy is very much your focus. What do you think? What kind of response can we make regarding this Republican war on women and how it's impacting the economy? There are people who say that the reason they're trying to put this force, this pressure on women again, is to get them out of the workplace. They see the fact that women have left the home, left the children, that this is essentially trying to get them barefoot and pregnant back in the homes. Do you see that kind of economic warfare component to this women's battle the Republicans seem to want to wage?
Absolutely. I think for a long time people were dividing the whole corporatist agenda with the war on women, but they're really going in the same direction. If you look at the whole ALEC agenda, right, it's to eliminate sex education, eliminate family planning like Planned Parenthood, reduce access to abortion, education. It's not just targeting women. It's sort of a whole range of services and things that lift us all up out of poverty. The cumulative result of all these policies, if you think about putting them all together in terms of across the board, it results in younger parents with less education. It reduces the odds that these younger parents will finish education. So then you're creating a permanent underclass.
The thing that seems so difficult to comprehend, they seem to not want to follow the logic. You know, you cut back on school programs, you cut back on education programs, you cut back on Head Start, you cut back on family resource issues, and then you wonder why women are working. You know, there's no motion whatsoever. We've been stuck in hold for women's pay equity for so long. And yet these guys want to debate birth control from the 1800s. It just boggles the mind.
It really does. It's cutting back on women's autonomy. I mean, it doesn't seem like necessarily a pure war on women, because right, at least for now, you're not restricting like what women wear or where they can go or things like that. But although when you start,
I wouldn't say that too loudly.
I know, right? But when you start attacking the Girl Scouts, for heaven's sakes, I mean, that's there's no rational reason for that, except that they're trying to restrict women's opportunities. Women are more are a higher percentage of the educated population now. So when you're cutting back on education, if you limit women's opportunity to education, that does more to limit education, period, than just cutting back on the population as a whole. Do you see what I mean?
Okay, hold on, hold that thought. I'd like to introduce Susan Smith, who just joined us.
Hello.
Hello, glad Susan. Welcome.
Hi. Hi. How are you?
Susan, I've got Meredith Ackman, president of Now Palm Beach. I've got Anita Stewart, Hillsborough Soil and Water Conservation Board. Jan Duma, deputy national director for Plan. And now you, Susan Smith, president of Democratic Caucus of Florida, and so many other things. I've got such talented women here, I don't even know where to begin. But Susan, let me ask you, just tell a little bit about what you're working on right now.
Well, this afternoon we had we did a three-hour training with about 25 activists on power and issue advocacy and the legislative process. We talked about lobbying and how to do it and how to keep doing it once session's over, and just ways that people can build a power base.
Well, that's fantastic. Ladies, I want to throw a couple questions out so that you can all kind of discuss them, and then I'm going to ask you to talk about some things that you think are important to focus on, because I want to kind of tease out some questions, but also I want to give you the space to talk about some of that stuff. My first question is, once upon a time we thought it was only they were going to try to limit access to abortion. Some people were worried that eventually they would get around to the issue of birth control. My first question is, where do you think they're going next? And let me ask first that of Meredith.
Where do I think
they're going
next? Well, I think that they are where they've been trying to go. Like, I think what they're trying to do is limit piece by piece a woman's right to abortion, a woman's right to access safe health care. And ultimately, that's what they're going to continue trying to do little by little, and that's what they've been doing. The best thing that we can do is make sure that people are conscious of the coalitions that are trying to combat that, so that we can make sure that we bring people together let me put it this way. Mob mentality is a really dangerous place to be. If people think that others are on one side, they're more likely to, those people who are on the fence are likely to fall on the wrong side of the fence. So the best way that we can continue to raise awareness is to make sure that they're safe, that there's education in schools, make sure that there's comprehensive sex education in schools as far as reproductive health, and make sure that we continue to put the word out that we're here and that we're going to continue to do, to protect women's rights.
Thanks, Mary.
From a legislative side also, it's so important to make sure that people are conscious of what's going on in the legislature. Too many people don't even know who their representation is.
Yep. Anita, any thoughts on this?
I can't put it any more plainly and clearly than Meredith just did. I think it's bit by bit and piece by piece, and whatever they can change or legislate along the way to take. I mean, the one thing that has me troubled very deeply is the tests now that females in some areas have to go through before they can even have an abortion. And when this is made into law, this is just one way they can sneak something in, make it a mandate, and then try to discourage women from having a say-so about what happens with their bodies and whether they're going to go through reproduction or not. And this is just, we're going, instead of going 10 steps forward, we're going 10 steps backwards each time something like this is legislated. So awareness is the big key here. We have to let people know that this is what's going on, and we have to demand our rights.
Thank you, Anita. Jan, is this the outside of the envelope, or they're just going to retrench there, or do you think they've got further to push?
Oh, I think they have further to push. I see them number one ramping up their 2012 campaign for congressional and state legislative and issue campaigns with all the money that they have to spend. I see them using, for now at least, women. The whole war on women makes a good distraction from other things that they're doing, as well as something that they want to push. But it's also, it gets people so riled up and excited that they don't notice other things that the various state legislatures are sneaking by, cutting education, creating more benefits for corporations, what the Supreme Court is doing. I noticed in the last recently that the Supreme Court has cut way back on class actions. They're now hearing a sort of an affirmative action case, and you don't hear anything about that because it's all about these more inflammatory issues.
That Miranda decision they just made?
Excuse me?
There was another decision that Kagan signed on with the conservatives on limiting Miranda more.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Thanks, Jen.
That's the sort of thing we're just not hearing about. Yeah.
And Susan, let me ask you: do you think that we've heard the outer edges of the Republican rightward push on women's rights?
You know, I think it's very complicated. I would agree with Jan that this is a distraction. I think they did start to kind of, fire up their base, and I think it's gotten a little away from them. I think there are a lot of convenient partnerships in this. I think the Catholic bishops, I read somewhere, this is like the dying gasp of a bunch of irrelevant old men who are trying to assert themselves one last time. I think this is, the moral majority folks from back in the 80s and 90s that were out there, they're trying to keep them engaged because they're all losing their jobs, the economy's hurting them. So I think this is a distraction from all the corporate push. If you study the legislation that's going down, and actually Jeb Bush's little right hand woman, what's her name? Patricia Levesque is her name, I think, that runs his foundation.
Mm-hmm.
She was quoted in either Mother Jones or The Nation in this article about how during the Senate Bill 6 fight, everybody had a chance to organize against it. So what they were going to do, they had a strategy. She actually said this. They had a strategy of throwing as many things against the wall as they could so that they separated us and they kept the other side too scattered to really focus on what the one or two things that they're really trying to push through. So I think it's very scattershot on their part intentionally so that we can't really organize. So I think our best bet is to form coalitions and work together and try to stay focused and not be distracted by some of these issues like, I'm not sure. Some of the bills that are out there are just distractions. There's no way they're going to go anywhere, like because the Republicans don't want them either, but they know that it will keep us fighting. Maybe the one about gender and race selection, one of the anti-choice bills that Senator Siplin and I can't remember who the person in the House is, but, to keep people from having abortions because of race or gender, when I don't think there's any documented case of anybody doing that in this country. So, they're doing it to divide the women from the racial minorities, and it's and everybody from, the general population of white men, and it's a giant distraction.
Well, let me tell you a couple, I think, positive or at least humorous counterattacks that have been made and get your reaction to that, and then also get you to start thinking about some short and long-term strategy. Of course, we all heard that the counter to that incredibly invasive internal ultrasound for women was a similar test.
Transvaginal, say the words. Transvaginal.
Thank you. Yeah. that men who are seeking Viagra should get the same sort of intrarectal exams, and that any talk of vasectomy should be also shown. They should be shown films, and of course the outlawing of masturbation again as a way of protecting every sperm that's sacred, just like every cluster of cells. And also, let me say something else that I almost never get a chance to say. I want to salute a profile in prison courage from a Republican woman. Senator Paula Daugherty of Lakeland released a smoking gun report showing that her research on private prisons, they actually cost more to operate than public facilities. My goodness, you know, God bless her, standing up to Republicans who are giving away another corporate boondoggle. But to get away from the humor now for a second, what's our best approach, short-term and long-term? Let me go ahead and start with you, Meredith. Education, you said, making people aware. What else can you say? What's our best response to this incredible 19th century thinking?
Well, I think short-term, it's going to be continuing to find the organizations that are helping to fight the fight, continuing to make sure, you know, if you're not getting emails from Palm Beach County Now or from Planned Parenthood, or from, you know, from some of the other organizations that are doing women's work that are you know, doing the work to further the cause of women, make sure that you are getting that. If you haven't gotten Palm Beach County Now's mailing list, if you go to our website www.pbcnow.org, the front page gives you on the top right corner of the picture, it gives you the opportunity to click in and you can give us your email information and contact information, and we send out action alerts and emails about things that are happening immediately. So if we need to contact our legislature because a certain bill is coming up, or if there's something that's going on, you find out about it. And it's the same thing. Planned Parenthood's been outstanding about that as well. And there's tons of organizations that are doing the same kind of work. As far as a long-term strategy, that we need to get Barack Obama elected again. He's going to have a direct effect on the yet another Supreme Court appointment. We've got huge issues that are going to be coming up, and we really need to make sure that he's the president again, because none of these other guys seem as though they're going to be able to handle it.
And we'll see you on the 18th at the Susan B. Anthony dinner or luncheon.
It's a luncheon. It's from 12 to 3. It's going to be amazing. And Judith Seltzer is our Feminist of the Year. We've got an all-star cast of characters, which includes Kelly Skidmore, past now president Patricia Ireland, Nan Rich. You know, we've got Mona Reese is going to be there. It's just going to be an incredible event. And they can also go to our website and find out information about that as well.
Thanks so much, Meredith. I sure appreciate it. Okay, Anita. Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks for having me again, Richard. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome, dear. Anytime. Anita, can you address a short-term, long-term strategy? What do you think?
I'm not sure about a long-term strategy, but I would say right now we need to bird dog every single person in power, and we need to know what they're doing. And like Meredith had said, information needs to get out right away. I would say utilize all the tools in the toolbox by using your social networks, networking with the people that you know, and making sure everyone is kept informed. And as far as a long-term strategy, that was the short-term. As far as a long-term, I couldn't even begin to say. I don't know, we don't really know what's going to happen in November. So I think after November, we'll know what we need to do.
And your show is on when again? Monday nights, 8 to 10?
We're going to be on Monday night and Monday night, tomorrow night from 8 to 10. That's Eastern Standard Time. Our special guest tomorrow night is Sandy Oestreich, and she's going to tell us all about the Equal Rights Amendment. She's going to give us a little history about it and what we need to do now.
Thanks so much.
Very, very. It's going to be a good show, so I hope people can tune in.
Well, you keep doing the good work that you're doing, okay?
Thanks.
Jan, what do you think, long-term, short-term?
we need to stop responding and just responding to what conservatives throw at us. We need to be proactive and create our own vision of what we want the world to be. We need to get that out there so that everybody that is a progressive can say the same sorts of things. We need to create get all the people that are blogging on progressive and liberal issues, get them together to create the same sort of echo that the conservatives do. For instance, when the progressive budget came out, there was very little peep in the whole blogosphere about that. If we had had something, if we had had that kind of organization, we could have really taken that progressive budget and made it something that we could all rally around. Same with the letter that the Occupy Financial Side just wrote to the SEC, the 325-page letter.
That was great.
That wasn't that, but you people aren't going to read 325 pages. So we've got to say, okay, this is what we're focusing on right now, and just write about it until it permeates the people's minds as well as the conservatives have been able to do with their media.
Let me ask you a question. It's always been my contention that the reason we haven't got to women's pay equity is because we've had so many other ancillary, small other battles to fight. I think that would exactly mirror your comments, that we're responding too much to their flash moment attack and not keeping our eye on the long-term ball. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, although there's other things going against that too. I mean, the same thing we had trouble getting the Equal Rights Amendment passed is the same thing that's getting that's holding back women's pay. And the same thing that made it harder, when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were both running in 2008, I looked at the two of them and I thought that Hillary was more electable at first. But boy, I was wrong about that. So there's a real deep sentiment against women that just hasn't gone away. And I think it's not even been as exposed as openly as racism has been. I was going to say too, originally, in terms of the cluelessness of the men deciding about women's health, did you know it used to be that all health issues, all medical research was done on men, and whatever effects on women, it was just extrapolated. Now we know that, for instance, women and men have different symptoms of heart attack. We didn't know that for a long time. We just studied men and assumed that women had the same symptoms.
Yes, unfortunately, it's one of those misguided gentility downsides, I guess you could call it. Maybe putting a best face on it, they didn't want to experiment on women, and maybe that's the reason. But ultimately, as you say, it turned out to be very negative consequences because they weren't really testing it the way it needed to be tested. In terms of a long-term strategy to deal with this inherent long-term racism, with the Republicans working so hard at limiting early child education, limiting access to birth control, the logical fallout is that is larger, poorer families with less resources who are poorer educated and who are therefore going to be at greater and greater economic risk. I just wonder what strategy we can have other than trying to mobilize and inform people to somehow fight this steamroller that's funded by so much right-wing corporate dollar.
It's not just – I mean, certainly we have to get education back, but we need to be aware that it's not just education. We also – over the next 10 years, the Bureau of Labor Statistics predicts that the nature of the jobs available in this country will change such that – there will be an increase in low-skill jobs, an increase in high-skill jobs, but those jobs in the middle will dwindle significantly. So even if we create a better education platform for people, we also need to have jobs available for them to do once they get out. So we need to be aware of both sides of that.
Thanks very much. Susan, let me ask you, what are your thoughts on a long-term strategy and a short-term strategy with this Republican war on women?
Well, I think I do think it starts with education. I've spent a lot of time on this issue since back in the spring, and I'm working with the moms from Fund Education now who are suing the state legislature over funding for our schools. And I think the reason it's so important is because there is an effort with charter schools to resegregate our schools. And I think also, and this is still evolving in my head, and I think there's so many balls in the air and so many pieces to it. But my sister out in California is very involved in her children's elementary and middle schools and high school, one's in high school now, with the arts, because they've cut so many of the arts programs. And what you were just saying about the labor force, my sister's just read a book, and I looked it up yesterday, and it's 6 years old, but I think Daniel Pink is the person that wrote it, and it's about the whole mind. And one of his ideas, and I think it's pretty true, is that the jobs that use the side of the brain, and I get my left brain and right brain confused, I think the right brain is the creative side, and all of our education is aimed at the left brain. So we're trying to put people into math and science and these and technical fields that are being outsourced, and we're not developing the side of the brain for the creativity and to take us into the future. And we really, at our schools, with all the testing and the focus on standardization, we're not providing the right kind of curriculum, and it really is a corporate takeover. Our schools are being defunded. There's a bill, I just got an action alert from PTA about this school grading, and what they're doing, they also are passing this parent empowerment bill. So what they're doing is they're going to force all children into this grading system. More schools will fail, and then parents can be empowered to turn the schools over to private charter companies. So it's really sinister what's going on. Alex is behind it, American Legislative Exchange Council. Jeb Bush is behind a lot of it. Michelle Rhee has people working in the state now trying to infiltrate groups like the Democratic Party to get them to buy into this education reform. And unfortunately, our president and his education secretary, along with mayors like Cory Booker, who are, building such a reputation within the party, have bought into a lot of this. So I think this is a crucial issue for the future as far as education is concerned. And we know Rick Santorum doesn't even want anybody to go to college, let alone women, I'm sure, because of his ideas. But I think that's a crucial issue we've got to get on top of now, because it's happening right before our eyes. And when Meredith was talking about educating, so many people have never heard of ALEC. And I don't think even a year ago I had heard of it. It's been around since the mid-70s. If you go into a group, I guarantee you can go into a group of activists, progressive activists, and half of them will not have heard of it. So we have a tremendous amount of education to do as far as what's really going on behind the scenes. So I think that's one of our short-term strategies. We've got to get in front of groups and educate them about ALEC, about Jeb Bush, about the Koch brothers, and all this corporate takeover that's going on. And then long term, I think our best bet is to form coalitions. When I was up in Tallahassee with the with Planned Parenthood on Tuesday, our lunch speakers were Damian Filer from Progress Florida was a speaker, and there was somebody from the ACLU and somebody from Planned Parenthood from Atlanta and somebody from the Senate Victory in the Democratic Party, and they were all talking about successes. And they all agreed that where we've had limited success, or success that's limited to one or two issues, it's because we form such strong coalitions that the other side knows they can't go against us, because people really are more powerful than money when you can get them out and get them engaged. So I think long term, that's what we have to do. Short term, I think these specific issues, there's a lot of education with the women's issues, with the education, with the environment, with labor and the workplace rules. Anyway, so I could probably keep going, but I'll stop and see if
let me ask you a question, Susan. While you're still talking about education, there was a question I wanted to ask you. We had Mr. Jeb Bush as governor for too long here in this state, and as I know you probably recall, he had a nefarious plan to thwart the public's will on smaller class size, and we know he's very much behind these corporate schools that will then take funding from the public to support their private enterprise because it's so much more efficient, especially when they can be taxpayer underwritten. You know, a lot of talk with this, the general dissatisfaction with Republican candidates is that Jebby may emerge from the smoke-filled halls of Tampa as the savior of that party. Do you hear anything? Hear any speculation on that count?
Well, I think the Republicans know they're going to lose in 2012. This is my own. This is me, but I've heard other people say the same thing, that he does not want to run until 2016 because he doesn't think the Republicans are in position to beat Obama. So he's holding back. Now, I will tell you, he's going around the country. This past week he was in Tulsa and he was in Dallas giving speeches. So one of the things we need to do is try to have, I don't like to call it rapid response so much as try to get ahead of his appearances and let people know, you know, where he is and what he's doing, because we've got to not let people forget who he is and what he's done and how he stands to gain. He's pushing online and virtual schools. He has a stake in a company that deals with online and virtual. And I just have to tell this one story. I got into an ALEC meeting in Tallahassee a couple of weeks ago, and I heard Representative Tobia. They were talking. He's a college instructor. And I heard him. They asked him directly about student engagement in, I don't know if it was fiction, nonfiction, certain kinds of materials. He said, oh, just very offhand, I didn't know who he was until after this meeting. He said, oh, I teach at the college level. And he said, you know, I teach online. He said, my students are nothing but a name and a social security number to me. I don't even know my students. I don't engage with them. Now, if the teacher on the other side of the, you know, the web is saying that about students that he's currently teaching, then I think this is very frightening, that we're trying to put more children in front of these computers from an earlier age. You've got to have, you know, teacher involvement, and you have to have a real person in front of small children. So that's the mentality. But Jeb has to be exposed, coming and going, if we want to prevent him from running in 2016.
Thanks so much. And let me ask one last question of my dear guests, Anita and Meredith. Let's see, excuse me, Anita and Jan. You know, I heard somebody say, it was just a conversation, that more midwives are taking training in how to do, let's say, informal abortions outside the medical system, and they saw that clearly women's access to abortions in medical settings with hospitals, with insurance, is going to be lost. And they saw this as becoming a new growing underground of that kind of care. And I just want you to react to that. Is that a good solution, or do we have to absolutely hold the line and make sure women still have access to this, that families still have access to the abortion treatment?
Well, I can speak on that. I can speak on that as a licensed medical professional myself. Number one, that's going to take us into some dark recesses of the past, and, of course, nothing regulated. there's going to be people out there that aren't going to be doing that procedure honestly and possibly sterilely, and they're going to, women are going to be relegated to back alley abortions, which is going to endanger our lives. So I would say, in a way, it's good if you can keep it safe. Abortion should be safe, legal, and rare, in my humble opinion. But if this happens, you're not going to stop women from having abortions if the laws change. They're going to still get them. They're just going to find alternate ways to get them, and there's going to be there's going to be some casualties involved in that.
Yeah. Well, ladies, I want to thank you so much for joining me. It's been wonderful to have you. I want to try to do this at least once a month. Thanks from the bottom of my heart. You have given all our audience wonderful food for thought. Thanks so much. I'm going to end tonight's show with some humor from a special guest, Franny Sheridan, a lady who tells humor about her cultural background and her upbringing. Thanks so much, ladies, for joining me, and I hope to have you again soon. Thanks again.
Thank you,
Rick.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay, here we go. Let's see, Miss Sheridan. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome the charming and talented Franny Sheridan. Franny, welcome.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Rick.
Well, you may know this is one of the regular women's specials that I like to do. You know, too often the opinions of the majority on the planet aren't heard from. And I thought it would be a nice touch to bring on someone who makes funny for a living. So, Franny, what's new?
Well, you know, it's the reason that I do funny, or, you know, what people perceive of as funny, is really it's survival for me, Rick. It's, you know, without sort of looking to the humor and the darkness, I really... I'm not too sure how I'd be able to survive, because you know, it's amazing. Like, you know, it doesn't matter how old you are. Like, I don't know how old you are, but I'm like, you know, 750 years old, and you know, my parents can still make me crazy, like totally nuts. You know, like, for example, I absolutely love my dad. You know, my parents, I'm lucky to have them, but my dad, he always wants to come to see me perform, but whenever he does, he heckles me at my show. You know, it's like, it's kind of like what they used to do at home. Seriously, like last time, you know, I was just like in the middle of, you know, telling a joke. He just, like, he literally yells out his own random joke. You know, guy walks into a bookstore, says to the clerk, looking for a book, just came out, can't recall the title, about a guy with a short penis. And, you know, the clerk goes, it's not in yet. And the guy goes, that's it, give me two copies. Like, my dad, he's really funny, Rick, but he makes me, you know, crazier than I already am, which probably isn't hard to do, but, so, anyway, I could go on.
I know what you mean when you say that humor is a heck of a good response to some of the craziness in the world. I find in myself I can only be serious for so long until I have to crack wise myself. Tell me, what started you on the road to performing comedy?
You know, Rick, I was doing drama internationally, touring my solo shows, which are also based on my family, go figure, for almost 17 years. I started out as a comic in Canada when I was, you know, with Yuck Yucks. But I did a little stand-up earlier than that, but because of my particular upbringing, I came across a lot of obstacles performing, and I had a lot of people believing in me, a lot of pressure, and I wasn't ready. But I was touring as an opening act, and then a small-time theater producer actually approached me in Vancouver, Canada, to do a dramatic solo show. So anyway, cut to, I ended up doing solo shows about my family, but here's the thing. I had this amazing story because I was brought up with a secret about my family, to never, ever, ever tell anyone that we were actually Jewish and that my parents are Jewish Holocaust survivors, and I was raised Catholic. And that's a whole story in itself, but I was, prior to actually performing the solo dramatic show, this is a long answer, isn't it?
That's okay.
I ran the concept by my family, And they actually, some of the members of my family threatened me with legal action.
Really?
Yeah, and but not because they're on any level bad people, but simply because when you're brought up with such a feeling of terror and you know, admonished for, you know, wanting to tell people the truth of your identity, whatever you are, you know, whatever your identity is, if you're scared to reveal it, then it becomes systemic. And so, you know, here's their little sister, the little daughter, who, you know, after, you know, being told to keep the secret, is going to reveal it in a play in front of people. And I did.
So how long was the case in court?
Well, you know what? It would have been great press, but it didn't happen. Because what happened is I immediately, literally, there was a journalist in the audience after my very first, very rough performance in Vancouver, and I immediately received international press in a magazine called the Jerusalem Report, magazine which is published in Jerusalem and distributed to every major port in the world. And as a result of that, extended family members who had been searching for our family for over 45 years, ever since we went underground as Catholics, started to contact me, and that incredibly, you know, emotional reunion, plus, you know, luckily some positive press, you know, brought a lot of healing to my family, lifted a lot of shame and fear and terror, and we had this very public, very, you know, moving reunion with our family. And so it ended up being it took me like on a huge other course out of comedy into doing drama, you know, in front of many different audiences for 17 years.
Wow. I think speaking out with humor is as inspiring, is as socially activated as speaking out on political issues. So obviously your own career in front of the public has evolved tremendously.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a completely different experience. I have to tell you, like, you know, hearing people sniffle and weep in the darkness, and having them come up to me after a show and, you know, really wholeheartedly, red, puffy-eyed, thank me from the bottom of their hearts for, you know, sharing, you know, my story, however theatricalized, you know what I mean? It inspires them and all, and it's so rewarding. It's just so healing for me, as well as, like, it's just, you know, it's just different, but it's so much fun to hear the audience laugh. It's very... I can't tell you to laugh at the darkness, because, and it's difficult for me, it might not be for other people, for other writers, but as a writer, it's hard for me to find, you know, the humor in, like, my parents having post-traumatic stress disorder, and things that are, like, you know, subjects that, I love being able to find humor in subjects that, you know, other people, you know, may consider it taboo. I think it's all in the way it's done. And, you know, if obviously I wouldn't make fun of certain issues that weren't my own to make fun of. But being a child of Holocaust survivors, I believe I have the right. I'm, of course, with not making fun of the Holocaust, obviously. That's not, you know, that's not something I would ever do. But I'm making fun of having survived my childhood, you know, living in, you know, a post-traumatic stress disorder household.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, how people respond, whether it be to disaster or to life-threatening conditions, I mean, you know, nervous laughter is a common thing. And I think it's wonderful that you've taken this pain, this family trauma, and you've processed it into something that helps other people relieve their anxiety, relieve their daily trauma. Is your humor largely family-oriented? Do you do topical humor? Do you do a range of different topics, or... do you primarily do kind of human relationship humor?
It's pretty theme-related. It's theme-oriented, rather. It's family stuff. I mean, I don't do political humor. I don't do, you know, nothing too topical. I think there's so many good comics out there doing that. This is really my niche, and, you know, I don't think anyone else
thank
is
you
really
for
doing it. I mean, I'm kind of like Richard Lewis's
niche. My good fellow broadcasters,
something
Leo
Richard Lewis, the comic. It's kind of closest to that,
show,
but I'm not quite as tortured as he is. I'm mildly tortured.
So
I'm sort of like Richard. If Richard Lewis and, you know, Lucille Ball had a love child, kind of me. So yeah, that's more my thing. But it's familial. But I think it's very apparently it's very relatable to, you know, it's definitely interculturally relatable, because It's also very relatable to the gay community because it's like it's about coming out as a child of Holocaust survivors in a humorous is something that's not been done as a stand-up in the stand-up comedy world. So it's kind of like coming out as a gay person, but like it's not as much fun because like you know when you come out as a child of Holocaust survivors, nobody throws you one of those fun rainbow, you know, parades with naked people dancing around. Although that would be fun, huh, Rick? I look at a giant, you know, matzo ball-sized float, naked rabbis and stuff.
There we go.
Shit-faced on Spanish Chavez. I think it'd be great.
Well, I hear you just had a nice showcase. How'd that show go?
Oh, just great. You know, although it was an outdoor cabaret, and it happened to be one of those singularly freezing, beautiful Floridian nights. So it was kind of like doing stand-up comedy in a walk-in freezer. And it was funny that I was actually, honestly, it was like being some kind of Stephen King weird fairy tale. All the palm trees were blowing and, you know, people were huddled together under blankets. Nobody left. And I was really moved. And there was laughter, but it was sort of like freezing and like laughter icicles in the air. But it was one of those cold nights. So the venue where I'm performing has acquired a property right across the street, and it's larger, and it has an indoor and an outdoor cabaret. So, you know, for those cold nights now, I have a bigger spot, and that's Harold's, which is a very cool kind of New York Village-y style cabaret.
And where's that at?
In Northwood, which is really like an arty, villagey part of West Palm Beach. It's 509 Northwood. And
is that off of downtown or?
Oh, well, if you get airlifted by a helicopter
okay.
in the morning. It's basically the closest I-95 Palm Beach Lakes.
Okay.
Go down to Dixie, uh-huh. Swing a left on Dixie, and then swing a left to Northwood. And you're there. I'm there on the 10th and the 24th of March. I'm there every second and fourth Saturday of every month.
Excellent.
At 8 p.m. Yep, at 8 p.m. That's me.
Yeah.
And my show's called I Tried to Be Normal, But It Was Taken.
Well, Franny, you have a wonderful wit and a real nice turn of the phrase. I hope to catch one of your shows soon, and I hope our audience can come and see Franny Sheridan. And go ahead, the name of the show again is?
I Tried to Be Normal, But It Was Taken.
Well, very good. Do you have a website, Franny?
Do indeed. It is my name. So, FrannySheridan.com, spelled FrannIe, S as in Sam, HeridanIe.com.
Thanks so much for joining us, Franny.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot from Rick Spezak, Progressive News Network, and co-producer Mickey Royce. Thanks so much for joining us. Hope you're tuning in next week. Bye-bye. Sponsored by Imagineering Productions and The Media Goddess. Thanks so much. See you next week.